The concept of using rolling backdrops is nothing I invented. It's been used in commercials, but I personally could not find anybody in Hollywood who remembered a road movie shot in the studio. Okay, there's scenes being shot, but like, how do you do a car chase in a studio and you're not using back projection, you're not using greenback?
The Austrian artist Edgar Honnetschlager espousing the values of going back to basics as he recounts the making of his road movie using his own painted backdrop. We'll head to Vienna to meet him soon. Also ahead,
it becomes extremely challenging when you have, for instance, a 3 hours or 2 hours and a half Kurosawa film to show, where you end up with like 12, 14, 16 reels sometimes. That is just like, we make them sweat, basically.
We visit London's Close-Up Film Centre to determine how to bridge that often wide gap between arthouse aficionado and mainstream multiplex. We'll also hear from director Penny Lane about her documentary Our Nixon and her latest feature focusing on lies and outrage of a rather different kind. And our look at Australian classics continues with 1975's Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Peter Weir's film is, above all else, I think for most viewers, a kind of wow moment in Australian aesthetics.
That's all to come on The Cinema Show, your culture guide to the world of film on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland, and coming to you from just outside the Close-Up Film Centre in London's Shoreditch today. It is a rather characteristically wet day, the skies are grey, and the heavens are well and truly open, as you can no doubt hear loud and clear. I am here to speak to Damien Seville, a man whose passion for the art of film drove him to build what's likely become one of the city's best-loved hubs for cinematic creativity. Let's wander inside and have a chat. Damien, lovely to meet you. Now, I have to say, I am surprised a little bit at my first impression of the close-up. It looks like a wonderfully cozy little cafe. I mean, you'd hardly guess there's a cinema here. The walls are all covered with books on all kinds of films and filmmaking, and everyone's clearly very relaxed. But as we wander towards the back of the cafe and turn a little corner, we find that we're actually huddled in what's essentially the foyer of a cinema that you built from the ground up. Damien, tell us the secret. How do you build a cinema?
We had very little money to start off with, so there's been a lot of DIY here involved. And also, I didn't want an architect to take over the project, because I've seen a lot of cinemas designed by architects and they're absolutely disastrous in terms of the experience of the audience. So I went myself with my tape measure in many cinemas and started to measure the distance between two seats and the distance, the throw to the cinema, the screen, for instance, and different things like that. And in regards to, in hoping to create the best experience possible in this space, considering the constraint of the actual dimension of the building and what we could do or not. And we didn't want to maximize the spaces in trying to squeeze in as many people as possible from a money point of view, a ticket sales point of view. We just wanted to make sure that anyone sitting here would enjoy, whether on the first row or the back row, the best experience possible in terms of the screenings.
Now, those more accustomed to the multiplex style of cinema will probably be quite shocked to see your setup. I mean, we're talking about a viewing experience for about 40 people. Do you think that limit on the number of people that you can actually house here actually plays quite well into creating that feeling of intimacy?
In regards to audience, it's hard to tell yet, because we're still building our audience, and so far it's fine. It contains, we have an average sometimes 4 houses, a little bit less, so it's absolutely manageable. But if we had more people willing to see those films, which I hope will be the case in the near future, then we can maximize the space by having several screens, in the sense of having a 4 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the afternoon screening of the same film. So basically, we multiply those 40 by as many times we're showing the film.
Well, while the close-up has joined the ranks of London's independent cinema scene, it's really aiming to be something more, I think. Damien, let's wander inside the projection booth.
So here you've got two 35 Kinoton projectors, and it's called a changeover system where films are sent to us in boxes, and a film is broken into generally about 4, 6, 8 reels, depending on the length of the film. And the job of the projectionist is to ensure that there is a smooth changeover between reels on each one of the projectors. So the reel one will go on to projector A and reel two on projector B. And as soon as reel one is finished, it's synced with reel two. The projectionist has to then take reel one off and bring reel three, etc., etc.
So it's a fairly technical process. There's quite a bit involved in making sure that that changeover takes place. From the audience perspective, what happens?
From the audience, they don't see anything in terms of, unless a problem with the cue dots and the changeover is not as smooth as expected, but they don't see it's absolutely smooth as synced. In the what we call the engine room here, there's a lot of gymnastic involved in terms of making sure that everything is absolutely synced. And it becomes extremely challenging when you have, for instance, a 3 hours or 2 hours and a half Kurosawa film to show, where you end up with like 12, 14, 16 reels sometimes. And that is just like, we make them sweat, basically. From the audience point of view, obviously, they're seeing a print rather than a digital file. Again, I've got nothing against DCP, but it's true that there is a big difference in terms of the feel and the experience of watching a film on film.
We'll hear more from the Close-Up Film Centre's Damien Seville later in the show, including the cinema's very impressive film lending library. For now, though, let's transport ourselves to the beautiful city of Vienna. The road movie is a time-honoured genre that has taken various forms and guises over the decades, but even in this rich lineage, Los Feliz by Austrian artist-cum-filmmaker Edgar Honnetschlager is a one-off. Named after a neighbourhood in Los Angeles, it's a road movie shot almost completely in the studio using props and rolling backdrops made by Honnetschlager himself. The film premiered in Vienna last month, accompanied by a special exhibition at the city's spectacular Ein und Zwanziger Museum. Monocle's man in Vienna, Alexei Korolev, takes us inside.
Those who make the images rule the world.
No. Those who create the images rule the world.
This is the mantra repeated throughout Los Feliz, or Los Feliz, to give it its Spanish name. An enigmatic tale of self-discovery, but it turns comic, touching, and frankly quite disturbing. It is, of course, much more than just that. At its heart, it's a scathing critique of Western culture with its obsession with image-making. But it also raises some fundamental questions about religion and belief, good and evil, life and death.
That's why you are in charge.
Who?
The West. Christian serves illusion to everyone.
Illusion. No wonder it took its director Edgar Honnetschlager a grueling 15 years to make. Partly because of red tape.
Well, the concept goes back to a trip to LA, to Los Feliz in 2000. And of course I went into writing right away and I wanted to realize it, but I couldn't find money for the project for 3 years. And then I gave it up, I couldn't take it anymore.
And partly because of reel tape. Edgar made a point of fashioning all of the film's scenery himself.
Then I'd expected to spend 3 months for drawing and painting, and it took 3.5 years. I guess it has nothing to do with being lazy or something, but America's a big country. And it's all American iconography. Liquor store, diner, gas station, bar, and so on. And all of this had to be created. The concept or using rolling backdrops is nothing I invented. It's been used in commercials, but I personally could not find anybody in Hollywood who remembered a road movie shot in a studio. Okay, there's scenes being shot, but like, how do you do a car chase in a studio and you're not using back projection, you're not using greenback? There is a huge canvas and it keeps on moving. It's like one frame, it's like a movie in a movie. There's one painted frame that keeps on going. And this has a lot to do with crossing the United States. Anybody who's done it, going from New York to LA, knows exactly how there's like endless repetition. So this can easily be expressed in painting because you pass the desert and it's the same cactus that comes over and over and over again. And then there is the mountains, there is the...
The film takes place over 7 days, a reference to the biblical book of Genesis, beginning in Rome and ending in Los Angeles, with a sort of abridged version of the mainland United States in between. It tells the story of Lydia, played by aspiring French actress Paulina Quart, as she seeks fame and fortune, accompanied by Kaya, an oriental half-goddess and principal chauffeur, and Salvatore, a devil.
Roll it, boys.
The film's various backdrops are set in motion by three Catholic cardinals pitted against the Chinese for control over image production. Quite a mix.
The bottom line is, those who make or create the pictures rule the world. Among all the monotheistic religions, Christianity is the only one that made paintings, images, the center of its convincing power. Because in Islam, in Judaism, it's simply forbidden. Okay, yes, you have Hinduism, you have Buddhism, but only in Christendom, and especially in Catholicism, you have a clear decision for the painting, getting people believe into a certain message. Good painting can unify a lot of people, and Hollywood definitely understood that message. Film is 110 years, painting is thousands of years, more or less as for as long as humans exist. And it's still developing. Is film developing? Isn't it very stuck in many, many ways? This is also a question the film asks.
Oh, I like the sign. Also yeah. Very 50s. Yeah. And the last word from director Edgar Hornetschläger himself.
But I think it's my task as an artist and also as a filmmaker to give people a new option or a different kind of food, you know, because it might like trigger some thoughts they didn't have up front. And I think that's the task of art.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Alexei Korolev there, wandering the halls of Vienna's impressive Ein und Schwanziger Museum with artist and filmmaker Edgar Hornetschläger. The Sorry Saga of Richard Nixon is one that we all know too well. Having endured a poor childhood, he catapulted himself into a high-flying political career, becoming a somewhat unlikely presidential candidate opposite JFK in 1960. Well, that contest didn't exactly go to plan, and he soon found himself in the political wilderness, only to launch back into the presidential spotlight with an even more ferocious appetite to succeed at any cost. The spectacular downfall of America's most notorious president has inspired many filmmakers, from Oliver Stone's 1995 film Nixon to the legendary All the President's Men in 1976. However, director Penny Lane took a somewhat different approach back in 2013 with her documentary Our Nixon.
It was an extremely exciting time for all of us.
You work for the President of the United States. You all elected him, and it's up to us to make it work.
I've never laughed as much as when I worked in the Nixon White House.
And if the music is square, it's because I like it square.
We had pranks and incredible friendships, and it was our personalities that made it all nice.
Even though the information may have leaked out, until I say it, it's not official.
We're on, and we're smart.
Made entirely from archival footage, a mixture of Super 8 tapes taken by his aides during his years in the White House, and some old news snippets, the documentary sets out to construct what's perhaps the most personal portrait of the former president yet seen. The film's director, Penny Lane, joins me now on the line from her home in Madison County in the state of New York. Penny, so many filmmakers have attempted to capture the elusive truth behind the Nixon enigma. What made you want to craft your own take on it all?
The secret for me was always just to keep the focus on the home movies. You know, the Nixon presidency is very well documented and it's very interesting. And there's really no end to the kind of archival paths you could go down. I mean, there's like almost infinite material. And it's all really interesting and it has the potential to kind of like distract you as the filmmaker. But I had to just keep reminding myself that the whole purpose of this film, that what we had that would be special and different, was these, you know, beautiful Super 8 home movies that were so unlike any other archival element we'd ever seen or were ever likely to see of a U.S. presidency.
Well, let's talk about your latest film then, which is titled Nuts. It's tempting to say that this film concerns itself with something entirely different, but I guess in essence, what we're really talking about is another con man here, an audacious so-and-so who gets his own way with deceit for far too long. Do you think there's something about these such out and proud, dishonest people that particularly fascinates you?
Yeah, it was interesting to spend so many years with John Brinkley and Richard Nixon sort of simultaneously, because I was working on both films at the same time. Yeah, I think that what's interesting about both of those characters is really two things. One was that they shared a kind of very specific 20th century American tragedy. You know, they were both born around the same time with really nothing, like just in total poverty. And both of them kind of, you know, through their own hard work and determination and genius, work their way to the very tops. And then both of them bring themselves down, really through their own actions and through their own hubris. So they shared that. But the aspect that you're asking about is a different thing, which is that they both tried to, as we all do, control the narrative of their own biographies. They both worked very hard to create, you know, using the media and other aspects and other forms to sort of control the story of their own lives and, like, you know, create the narrative they wanted history to remember them by. And again, both of them fail because their histories and their biographies are essentially based on, I'm not going to say Richard Nixon's case entirely a lie, because not like everything he ever did was a lie, but certainly a lot of deception and deceit and secrecy. And in Brinkley's case, obviously, really everything was a lie, like everything he did.
To cure your impotence, you want me to implant goat testicles into you.
Well, Doc, that can't be worse than the nuts I got.
That was a clip there from Nuts, Penny Lane's latest documentary, which recounts the absurd story of Dr. John Romulus Brinkley and his horrifying medical scam involving transplanted goat testicles, as well as his unlikely yet enormously successful media career, which very nearly saw him become governor of the state of Kansas, electing an absolute nutbag. We wouldn't know anything about that. Well, Nuts premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this year, but as you'd know, the cinema show is presented in association with Mubi, the curated movie site of cult, classic, and award-winning cinema. And subscribers in the US can catch Penny's 2013 documentary, Our Nixon. It's playing right now. Up next, we'll explore the Close-Up Film Center's lending library, and we'll settle in for a picnic at Hanging Rock.
Monocle's unrivaled network of editors and correspondents around the world bring you a brilliant new collection of books, the Monocle Travel Guides, and the series kicks off with New York and with London. London can be a big beast to tame, even for the people who get to call it home, but this ever-changing and regenerating capital can also charm you with its beauty. The Monocle Travel Guide to London is a celebration of all the things that the Monocle team loves about this mighty metropolis. And they're brave enough to let you see the wrinkles too. London's a global city, but the Monocle team will help you see it as a series of friendly local gems, with this guide to the shops, restaurants, music venues and museums we think should edge their way onto your itinerary. Whether it's a mid-morning run along the South Bank, the best Greek meal at Lamonia in Primrose Hill, or a handcrafted umbrella from London Undercover, our fresh ideas will leave you with a clear, crisp view of the capital. Published by Gestalten, these books are for people who want to get the most out of their stay, however short, and feel like locals rather than tourists. Pick up the Monocle Travel Guide to London in Monocle shops at monocle.com and in all good bookstores. The Monocle Travel Guides. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 in association with Mubi. Well, the current issue of Monocle magazine is all about Australia. A special look at top diplomats, chefs, designers, and even some top wine destinations too. On last week's show, we took a closer look at the 1994 classic Muriel's Wedding. We'll hear from film critic Tara Judah again now, this time discussing the wonderfully haunting Australian classic from 1975, Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Stopped at 12. Never stopped before. Must be something magnetic.
Well after two, I'd say. We'd better be careful. I promised Mrs. Appleyard I'd have you lot back at the college by 8.
Except for those people down there. We might be the only living creatures in the whole world.
Tara, take us back to when this movie premiered. It's often credited with reigniting Australia's film industry, isn't it?
Yeah, so in 1975 when this film hit, it was like, hey, here's a new type of Australian filmmaking. This is different to what's come before. And I mean, I think, you know, the industry was still sort of quite young at that stage and probably the output was not immense anyway. So what we were starting to see was a real aesthetic. And Peter Weir's film is, above all else, I think for most viewers, a kind of wow moment in Australian aesthetics. Hadn't seen that kind of style of superimposition, slow dissolves, the kind of imagery and symbolism that's very rich in the film. So we get lots of lingering shots of the rocks, Picnic at Hanging Rock, you know, this kind of physical landscape just foreboding and being there. Musically, this film is really progressive as well. It uses the score often to stand in for conversation and exposition. And that really mirrors the nature of the film, which is that it's a mystery. You know, this is not a film that gives you answers. This is not a film that's going to spell everything out. So obviously, we've got to get lots of those clues through the visual and oral aspects of the filmmaking.
Now, Australia makes some brilliant films, but it's fair to say that we're not often compared to the best European auteurs, but this one often is.
Yeah, well, this film actually always gets compared as well to Michelangelo Antonioni's La Ventura, which I think is really interesting because that's also about a kind of disappearance on the rocks. So it does have that kind of status as being as good, if you will, as a European art house cinema, which I think in Australia at that time, well, that comparison's not really being made very early on. So this film has kind of already elevated the style of filmmaking. And I think once somebody does something, particularly in a small industry like Australia, it gives license to other filmmakers to follow suit.
Tara Judah, thanks as always for being here. Director Peter Weir's masterpiece was, of course, adapted from the wonderful 1967 book by Joan Lindsay. Just shy of the novel's 50th anniversary, the creepy turn of events is currently being re-examined in a new stage play penned by Tom Wright, which recently debuted at Melbourne's Malthouse Theatre. Are we any closer to discovering the truth behind the enduring mystery? We asked the Malthouse's artistic director, Matthew Lutton.
I think, like a lot of people, my memory of it is Muslim dresses, panpipe music, but my memory of it was also of a piece of horror, really. It was how that landscape sort of used to sort of monster the figures in the film. I think the film also conjured to me that it was always almost obscure, like there's always a sense of not being able to solve that mystery. And I think that's a great, you know, attraction to it for me and for a lot of people. It's something that feels very tangible, but at the same time feels like it just slips between your fingers when you watch it. All Australians have had some experience at some point of what it means to be alone in a landscape, to be out somewhere, outside of the city. Actually, we're a country that lives on the exterior. We live in such a small part. And when we get out of the cities and go into that vastness, the humbling experience of that, the terror that can come because of our lack of experience with it, that we're unable to tolerate it, unable to exist with it a lot of the time. So I think we've all had those experiences, and when we see it in a story pushed to the forefront, I think it resonates with us as a part of Australia that we know exists but often are ignorant of or prefer to ignore. I think that's one of the enduring appeals of it, that Lindsay wrote something that was unfinished. I mean, it's a really complicated matter, like in a film and in a piece of theatre, how to tell a story that has no ending. It's actually structured on being inconclusive. But Lindsay is, of course, looking at time continuously throughout the work and the idea of multiple times existing simultaneously. So it really suits her subject matter, that the idea that we can't see the end of it, we can't see the end of the tunnel of time.
You do know that Miranda might not come back.
knows lots of things other people don't know. Secrets. She knew she wouldn't come back.
I think the film has some extraordinary moments in it, but of course it also is a film that certainly has a take on it. Like, Miranda is really pushed in Peter Weir's version to be quite prophetic. There's a sense at the beginning of the film that Miranda is aware that this will be her final day, which actually isn't quite in the Lindsay. So our version sort of reflects that. But it's a really interesting thing, tracing the way you interpret Miranda, because it is a very much like a Jesus figure. It's a figure that becomes a deity, or after the fact, becomes far more important than when she was alive.
And quite young, geologically speaking. Barely a million years.
Waiting a million years. Just for us.
The play's been adapted by Tom Wright. And really, when we were beginning, we were always very clear we didn't want to do a dramatisation of the book in the same way that the film is a dramatisation of it. So we weren't going to have a cast of 17 actors and play out all the scenes. And that really influenced what we were thinking about. We ended up agreeing on a small ensemble of 5 girls that would tell the entire story. So immediately that meant actors were going to play multiple roles. They're going to play the men, the women, the teachers, the girls. And so it turned into an act of storytelling. Unlike the film, we can't show the landscape. We can only use Lindsay's language to describe it. So the work is 5 actors on stage who sort of become haunted and possessed by the story. They conjure that landscape and then sort of fall back into it as they're telling the story. The show is structured in some ways a bit like a thriller, like it moves quite quickly, but at the same time looking at how to have a thickness of language to really articulate all the landscape and the many ideas in Lindsay's text.
Matthew Lutton there, taking us through the brand new play based upon the classic Australian book and film Picnic at Hanging Rock, which is on at the Malthouse Theatre in Melbourne until March 20th. I'm currently browsing some of the titles in the Close-Up Film Centre's lending library with Damien Seville. Damien, I've just spotted the incredible 1945 film Scarlet Street by the director Fritz Lang. Now, I was looking for a copy of that just last night, it's a true story, and I quickly discovered that it doesn't appear to be available here in the UK via the usual means. Well, tell us though, how do you curate a collection like this one we see in front of us?
We've basically now, we have our routine in terms of we acquire all the films by the good distributors such as Second Run, UA Films, the BFI, etc., etc., to name a few. There's a lot of recommendations as well and requests by our members, because they have an extended film knowledge and they want to see a film by this director or this title, etc., etc., which we also we buy and populate our library with. So we have a recent acquisition section, which is all the back catalogue.
Damien Seville, thank you very much. It has been a pleasure. And that's it for this week's show. If you're here in London, you can catch one of my favourite films of all time, That's All That Heaven Allows, playing at the Close-Up Film Centre on March 20. And if you haven't yet signed up for Mubi, here's a treat for you. A whole month free. Strictly for listeners of The Cinema Show, head over to mubi.com/monocle now. From the Close-Up Film Centre in Shoreditch, I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.